All right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah. It's a great day to be out here today. It's just really incredible. And we got a tight and incredibly interesting show for you today. And at the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Ed Rampell, film historian, author, and critic. And he's a writer for Hollywood Progressive. And he's going to be talking about Rory Kennedy's, really, it's her homage to U.S. imperialism in Vietnam that was shown on PBS just a few days ago. Extremely important to check that one out. Before that, we will be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And Carl has issued a statement on Baltimore and the uprisings in Baltimore since last weekend down through to now. Yes, I'll get my speaking ability back in just a minute. And Carl's also up in Oakland, speaking at a rally in Oakland. The ILWU, who's actually closing the harbors down in support of the people standing up against police brutality. Just, that's a historic measure that's going on. And we will also be joined by Noche Diaz. Noche is from the New York Revolution Club, and he is in Baltimore as we speak and has been in Baltimore for the past week or so, all right? So that'll be very interesting. He's going to be talking with us about what's going on in the streets. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to, well, I'll tell you what. Here's the situation, you know. Cornel West, you all know we've been having a lot of, I've been having a lot of stuff around Cornel West and what his, and his dialogue with Avakian and other, his work, especially in relation with Carl Dix to stop mass incarceration. Well, you know, Cornel has come under some fairly severe attack of late. And it's very important that people of conscience need to stand up and step out and defend Cornel West. And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about right now. Cornel West has also come under attack by Michael Eric Dyson in a recent article in New Republic, actually it was in. So he's come under attack in an article by Michael Dyson in the New Republic. And it was just a scurrilous assault against Cornel West. And among the people that I've been checking out who've been speaking on this is Henry Giroux. And Henry is, he's been a guest on our show. He's the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University. And we had him on recently talking about his latest book. And Henry, he can correct me on this, but I want to welcome him on the show and stop talking because I sound like I'm just getting nervous here. All right, so I want to welcome Henry Giroux to talk with us about the recent attack on Cornel West. He wrote an article that I thought was very, very important, very, very apropos for what we're going to be talking about all day today, all right? So, Henry, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Hi.
Good to be on again.
Yeah. Good to hear you, man. Well, let's jump into this, Henry, because I want to get as much time as I can with you. Michael Eric Dyson wrote this article, a huge article, and in my mind, it's sort of like you look at it, and it's kind of stunning in the paucity of content, but then you step back, and there's a whole other game going on, and you talk about the article is character assassination on Cornel West, but it's so much more. What do you see at the heart of this assault?
Well, I think that many of the critiques, many of the defenses, and they've been a number of them, and a number of them are fabulous, that have taken up this defense of Cornel, have basically gone after Dyson by virtue of arguing that this is simply a character assassination and a defense of Obama, of course, Obama's policies. But I think there's something much more at work in this. I mean, I read the piece as symptomatic of two things, one of the sorry state of academic intellectuals, academic scholars in the United States who have really, in many ways, been appropriated by the councils of power and feel no obligation to really defend the important social issues such as Ferguson or what's going on in Baltimore, to speak out or to make the language accessible. And to not place themselves in positions where they can be rewarded with a Congressional Medal of Freedom someday. So I thought that it was really an attack on public intellectuals who are engaged, who are critical, who operate and write in multiple spheres. To claim that Cornell is basically just writing a bad scholarship is such an act of bad faith in many ways. I mean, because I define Cornell as an intellectual, as I would define myself. And that doesn't mean we don't do scholarly work. That just means we do a lot more than scholarly work. And I think that when you look at the various modes of intervention, the various roles that Cornel plays, he really, for me, exemplifies a very moving, stirring, and courageous public intellectual. I don't really care about his personal life, in terms of marriages. And that stuff is irrelevant to me. I mean, that stuff is the stuff of the Kardashian sisters and celebrity culture. And I think that when academics stoop to that, you get a sense of how bad their arguments are and what bad faith they're arguing. Secondly, it seems to me that, you know, we all have to address the fact that, you know, simply race is not enough as a point of identification when it comes to justifying certain kinds of politics. Clarence Thomas taught us something dreadful, you know, which is that simply because he's black doesn't guarantee a particular kind of politics, except in this case it offered a bad one. And I think that to defend Obama simply on the basis of representation, not on the basis of politics, is an egregious act of bad faith and bad theory and bad politics. And I think that basically Dyson falls into that. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, it seems to me that to get back to this question of what the Academy should be doing, I mean, I think that what Cornell does represents such an enormous threat to so many academics who find themselves in silos, talking in jargon that doesn't make any sense to anybody anymore, you know, writing about stuff that nobody cares about, that he exemplifies what Hannah Arendt once said, and that is that thinking is dangerous. It's become dangerous in the United States. But I'll tell you, and my last point is this, and maybe this opens up another kind of conversation, and that is that when I look at Baltimore, when I look at what went on in Ferguson, to me, many of these analyses are off base. Cornell would argue that it's not just about police brutality, as I would argue. And I think that what we need to do with these kinds of events is to understand them within a much broader context of authoritarianism and how it works in multiple ways and how police brutality is simply one symptom of the ongoing militarization, for instance, and financialization of the American economy. That's where Cornell is dangerous. In my mind, that's where he's really dangerous. He makes connections. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I tried to do in the piece.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to pursue some of that and some of it a little bit later. But some of it right now, you know, I want to get back to this thing about Dyson and his attack, which you say it reads like an apology for politics burdened by a bad faith defense of the status quo. And I was really kind of taken back. Basically, that really made me think a lot, you know, because it is true. It's exactly what it reads like. Let's talk about that.
I'll tell you what I mean by that. This is not to say I know Michael. You know, I've known him for many, many years. And this is not to say that Michael doesn't at times address important issues. But he addresses them within the framework of democratic politics, of the Democratic Party politics. And that's reformism. That's not taking a stance that matters. That's reproducing a system by making a claim that something is wrong and offering Band-Aids to fix it. The system is broken. The system doesn't work anymore. We need new political formations. We need new parties. We need a new understanding of what democracy is. And we need to stop believing that capitalism and democracy are the same thing. Dyson doesn't do that. He doesn't go that far. You know, nobody. He doesn't talk about apartheid in the United States regarding poor minorities. He doesn't do that. And he doesn't link those policies to the bad faith politics of Obama. You know, more immigrants, as you know, have been put in jail under Obama than anybody else, any other presidency. But it goes on and on. I mean, he's done nothing to alleviate the inequality and wealth and power in the United States. So he's really reproduced the problem. But I think that those intellectuals who are talking about a democratic socialism, who are talking about a different kind of system, who are talking about how we don't begin with people's deficits, we begin with their needs, that's a very different kind of analysis. And I think that when I say that's a bad faith defense of the status quo, what I'm saying is that he knows better. I know he knows better. He's smarter than that. But what he has done is he's allowed himself to be seduced by power, and he cuts the argument short. And in doing so, he does an injustice to the subject, and he does an injustice to his readers.
Well, let's go a little bit further on this, because you also talk, and I think there's kind of a unity between these two points that you make here, where you argue that Dyson's attack on West has to be seen not simply as a personal attack, as you're saying, but as a fear that liberal intellectuals have about the role of the left-oriented public intellectuals and the crucial role of pedagogy and changing consciousness in society today.
You bet. I don't really communicate with Cornell. I've written to him, but he doesn't answer. But I, at the same time, one of the things that I admire about him is that while he doesn't use my language, which is that the crisis in economics is not matched by a crisis in ideas, and that's about a crisis regarding the educative nature of politics itself. He takes seriously the fact that you can't just talk about economic structures as if that's all we need to do in order to address the problems that we have if anything is going to change. You've got to change the way people think. You've got to provide a discourse in which they can find themselves in the narrative. You've got to provide something that's meaningful to make it critical, to make it transformative. That's a pedagogical task. He does that. He deals with the question of ideas, and he does it in multiple contexts using multiple languages. That's the role of a public intellectual. That's the greatest fear that liberals have.
Mm-hmm.
That's the greatest fear they have. The greatest fear is that these unwashed, sort of radically edged public intellectuals can call a system, call it out, but do it in a way that makes sense, in a way that actually moves people, in a way that Du Bois moved people, you know, in a way that other intellectuals, I.F. Stone moved people, in a way that Michael Harrington moved people. And I think that that's why intellectuals like that, you don't get rewards. You're not invited to the White House. But at the same time, you become a mirror that reflects the deficits, ideological, political, and personal, that operate on the side of these liberal intellectuals who really have no right whatsoever to be siding more with the right than they are with the left.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Henry Giroux. And we're talking with Henry about Michael Eric Dyson's just heinous assault on Cornel West in a recent issue of The New Republic. Now, Henry, you know, you along those same lines, you argue, because it's even bigger than Dyson. Dyson seems to represent sort of, he's at this point, he's sort of like walking point for a certain trend that is actually right. Very dangerous and very, very important that people, you know, understand that it's going on. You say it's his article is an exemplar of the crisis facing the work of so many prominent intellectuals in the academy who have silenced themselves or lost themselves in the corridors of power. Let's
Absolutely.
Talk about that.
Well, I think that what you see in the university today, to be able to understand that comment, is you see a university that really has been hollowed out. I mean, academic labor now is temporary labor, it's casual labor, it's exploited. One of the fastest growing groups on food stamps in the United States. These people can barely make a living. And I think they live under the constant threat of being fired instantly. They bear the burdens of the ideological ruthlessness of what is called flexibility. And I think that for many of them, they just don't speak up because they might lose their jobs. And I can understand that. I don't agree with it, but I'm sympathetic. But you have tenured professors who know better. I mean, these are the people who have power, some power. These are the people who don't have to worry, for the most part, about losing their jobs. And these are the people who basically should be working as hard as possible to turn the university into a place that becomes a model for dissent, becomes a model for holding power accountable, becomes a model for a new kind of civic and political literacy. And when you see liberals not doing that, but siding in, or academics in general, conservatives and liberals, but siding instead with the academic, military, industrial, academic complex, then you realize not only what a site of struggle the university has become, but you realize how symptomatic intellectuals like Dyson, what they represent in terms of what's happening to the university, its corporatization and its depoliticization.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about what I announced at the beginning of the show about the assault on Cornell. And there really does need to be people who are willing, public intellectuals, who have a role to play in society that's different than many other people. They have a role, they have a means, they have the reach, you know, but so many, too many of them, whether it's around police brutality, whether it's around all the social issues that Cornell gets involved in and others get involved in yourself, you know, this point about actually standing up, the courage and the backbone and the real, to stand up and the real need for people to do that. And this thing of Dyson is really seems to be directed at sort of not just wagging a finger at them, but sort of that kind of speaking for the Godfather. You know what I mean. Right?
Forgive me for this analogy, and I want to say to your readers, it may be extreme, but it seems to me that just as they left that young black man's body in the street for 4 hours after he was dead, that wasn't just simply a misconception or an error on the part, an administrative error. That was a message to be sent. That to other black youth, look, take a good look. This is what happens when you dissent. This is what happens when you are considered disposable. This is what happens when you're excess. And I think that in a more literal sense, what we see in Dyson's discourse is something that's permeating and reproducing in different levels of extreme and in different levels of visibility a kind of protracted discourse of fear. You know, one that says, hey, look, we're calling you out. This is really to make you look so bad that you'll never write again. Regardless of what you say, we'll find a reason to focus on your deficits and embarrass you. We'll switch the argument. You'll pay a price for this. You may claim that you're not on your knees but are standing up as a public intellectual, but there are flaws there we'll find. I mean, I see this as a kind of intimidation that the right has been doing for a long time. Think of all those times when, you know, around Middle Eastern politics, when the right was putting the pictures and the names and the addresses and the phone numbers of intellectuals up on websites, calling them communists. David Horowitz doing this for the longest time. This is really a high-intensity war, which in Michael's case represents a version of the low-intensity war of that sort. You know, it's all dressed up as being academic and scholarly. But remember where he published this. He published this in the New Republic. Mm-hmm. The New Republic, which is shameful. The New Republic, after Edward Said died, wrote, after Howard Zinn died, after Alexander Cockburn died, wrote the most pernicious, scurrilous analysis of their work that I have ever read. It was nothing but a hit job. And if I were Michael Dyson and called myself a member of the left, I would never have participated in submitting anything to that magazine.
Yeah, very good point. And actually, you know, Horowitz, it's interesting. Horowitz is among the forces that are actually attacking Cornell and his appearance out at UCLA, which is, you know, to be expected, I guess. But it's also, you know, it sort of shows you how things are lining up and the importance of people of conscience standing up. You know, because there's a point about public intellectuals and the influence and the difference they can make in speaking out. And then there's the importance of when people do speak up and when they do step out, they need to other people need to have their back. It's a very real.
That's really smart, Michael. You know, you can't wage these wars alone. You know, they have to be exemplars of a kind of solidarity in which people are not speaking for their careers, but speaking to issues. And if they speak to issues, then that involves everybody, right? For those of us who believe in a radical democracy, that's not about Cornell. That's about a discourse we need to understand if the movement is going to move forward. I mean, public intellectuals are not there just to write articles or to speak to a larger public. They're there to provide aid and comfort and to provide a resource and to learn from and to work with social movements. And I think that's where Cornell is so dangerous, is that he actually does work with young people. He does work with social movements. And I think in many ways, he becomes an easy target because he's so visible and he's performative. You know, I mean, I think that one of the things that you often find about academics is that they live in this kind of dead zone of aesthetic, sort of an aesthetic nightmare. You know, they can barely speak. You know, they're not performative. And they don't link the body to the mind. He does all that. You know, so to call him out for being performative, I mean, I really found that one interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Henry, we have time for...
From Dyson, who whenever he speaks, imitates the role of the black preacher.
Right, exactly. I was just thinking that. Exactly, yes. Henry, we have time for one more question. Hopefully you have the time as well. And it's sure. We both read an article recently, an article that was by Lenny Wolf and Carl Dix, and it was on this whole situation on Dyson's article. And you made a point in your article, which is titled Rethinking Michael Eric Dyson's Attack on Cornel West, The Perils of Being a Public Intellectual, you made a point that in that article by Dix and Wolf, they do what other critics don't do, which is expose Dyson's genuflection not simply to Obama, but to the dominant registers of a lethal kind of politics that makes it impossible to associate the United States with even a vestige of democracy. Let's talk about that.
Well, I mean, I think that when you look at a country like the United States that is in the deep throes of now an almost sanctioned authoritarianism, I mean, we're not talking about tipping over. I mean, you know, when Princeton does a study and says that it concludes that we live in an oligarchy, Princeton is not exactly, you know, a center of Marxist study, right? Princeton University. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the urgency of the times in which the lethalness of the times in which we find ourselves demands an urgency in which questions of priority and questions of care and questions of analysis are so crucial that they take on a responsibility more profound than in the past. We're on the Titanic. And I think that public intellectuals now have never had such a responsibility as they do today. And I think they fail in that responsibility when they simply seem to suggest that the system needs to be reformed. That, for instance, all we need to do is put the crooks in Wall Street in jail. That's nonsense. We don't need to put them in jail. That'd be great. We need to break up the system that created them. Mm-hmm. That's a very different issue. When we look at places like Baltimore and we look at places like Ferguson, the issue is not making sure cops go to jail. The issue is making sure that the police are not simply an arm of the state there to enforce state terrorism. I mean, these are much larger issues that are the only issues we really should be addressing if we're going to get to the heart and the root of what it means to change this utterly pernicious and increasingly repressive system.
All right, Henry, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we're going to have you back a lot sooner, man. It's too long between discussions.
I love this program. I hope you have me back. I have a new book that just came out.
All right, I'll get it, and we'll talk about it.
I hope you have me back soon.
All right, Henry, thank you very much, man.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Henry Giroux. Henry is the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University. He is also a writer, as you just heard him talk about, and his most recent article is Rethinking Michael Eric Dyson's Attack on Cornel West, The Perils of Being a Public Intellectual. And also that article that I was just referring to that Henry and I have both read is available on revcom.us. It's an article by Carl Dix and Lenny Wolf, and it's called In Defense of Cornel West, Is Barack Obama Right or Has Michael Eric Dyson Lost His Mind? All right, and it's in Revolution Newspaper on revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we're going to be right back talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and Noche Diaz from the Revolution Club. And this is going to be a discussion of Baltimore and what's been going on there, so stay tuned. All right, that's just Siri X with Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder. Following the death of Freddie Gray in police custody, actually, let's just say the murder of Freddie Gray in police custody, there have been waves of protest in Baltimore and beyond. Monday, April 27th, people rose up and battled police. In the days after, protests spread across the country. April 29th, 100 people were arrested in New York City. Talking about these events from Baltimore will be Noche Diaz, who's joining us a little bit later in this segment. But we're also going to be talking with Carl Dix, who's a regular guest on this show. And as I said, he's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's joining us from Oakland, where he's speaking at a rally supporting the Longshore Union's shutdown of the ports to protest police killings of black and brown people. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, first thing I want to get before we start talking about your statement on Baltimore, I want to get your sense of like, okay, they've just announced that, hey, they're going to be charging the six Baltimore cops involved in the murder of Freddie Gray. They're saying that actually there's a basis to charge them with homicide. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Okay. We need to be very clear. Charging killer cops is not the justice we need. Cops need to be indicted. Cops who murder people need to be indicted, convicted, and sent to jail. We also need to look at exactly what the charges are. My understanding is that the charges on one of the officers includes murder, while the charges on the other officers range from false imprisonment, assault, and things like that. And they did falsely imprison Freddie Gray. They did assault him, but they also collaborated in his murder. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's what the charges are going to come down to. I haven't had a chance to look at them. I have also heard that it still needs to go before a grand jury, and I do have to say before a grand jury for what?
Yeah.
It shouldn't have taken this long. You had a dead young man. You knew who the perpetrators were. It shouldn't have taken this long, and there's really no need to build in further stops along the criminal injustice system, which when cops do the killing, function as off-ramps to let killer cops go. So that's what I know about it, and that's what I think about it at this point.
Okay, very important, man. Let's talk about the uprising in Baltimore. You issued a statement on this. Let's talk about it in terms of your take on this. What's so important about it? What do you think of it?
It was very, very important that people stood up in Baltimore because it's about Freddie Gray, but it's about much more than Freddie Gray. The Baltimore Police Department has a history of inflicting savage brutality and murder, especially on black people, although not just on black people. And it was very, very important that people stood up. When you think about it, there's even a name for what the police did to Freddie Gray. The cops call it giving you the rough ride. And it's the way that they punish people that they decide have defied them by running or whatever. They take you, they put you in the police van, and then they ride you around, stopping abruptly, quickly turning and things like that to bounce you around in the back of the vehicle. And then when you look at the fact that they arrest Freddie Gray 2 minutes away by police vehicle from the precinct that they're supposed to take him to, yet they ride him around for 40-some minutes. This was a question of giving Freddie Gray the rough ride, and it came down to murdering him.
You know, I was just going to say, you know, when you think about this, and I was in there, I happened to be in an East Coast airport earlier in the week, and I had, when I walked into the waiting area for the flight, it just was stunning because every television in the area was tuned into reports from Baltimore, and people were glued to it, and they were glued to that, and they were arguing with one another, talking about all this stuff, and the whole point in the background was the various point that the ruling class was trying to make around the rebellion and how to look at the people that were daring to stand up against police murder and demanding that it stop. One of the big questions of debate was the assertion by the ruling class that violence was just wrong. It was fine to go out in the streets and say, please stop. But if there was violence, if people were standing up and you know, who knows what they're defining as violence, but they say that these people were being violent and that was wrong. Your take on that?
Yeah, see, this is very important to be addressed. That's why I issued the statement that I did, because essentially what the authorities are saying is that it is okay for their cops to brutalize and even murder people. That's law and order. But if people stand up and express their righteous rage in response to that, well, they're being thugs and criminals. And that is, like, totally unacceptable. People should not accept the illegitimate brutality, the murder that's coming down. They have a right to, and frankly, a responsibility to stand up. And let's just get right down on the ground. Nobody would be talking about this if people in Baltimore hadn't stood up. Just like nobody would have been talking about Michael Brown if people in Ferguson hadn't stood up. It would have been just another black young man killed by police, justifiable homicide, end of story. People have not allowed it to be end of story by standing up and expressing their righteous rage. All of the people arrested should be released. The cops should be not only indicted, but convicted and sent to jail for the murder of this young man. And that's what they should be treated as, because that's what they are. They're murderers.
And when it comes to thugs, you want to talk about the real thugs? I mean, that's
exactly. Good
yeah,
point.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Carl, I can hear the background. There's a demonstration going on. I don't know if that's something that you're supposed to be in the middle of or not, but I don't know if you have any further comments to make. And then before we go into Noche.
Well, I just say that people need to join this fight. It's about Freddie Gray, but it's also about Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Rakia Boyd, Merrick Cornejo, and many, many other people. We need to build a movement that is taking this all across the country. And then, frankly, we need to build a movement for revolution, which we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are building, because this horror and all the other horrors are built into the fabric of this system. And it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end it once and for all. People should go to the website stopmassincarceration.net and revcom.us, find out what's going on, find out how to get involved.
All right, Carl, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks.
All right, take care. Bye now. Noche Diaz from the New York Revolution Club. Let's talk, brother. You've been in Baltimore since the very beginning, and you're still there now. What's going on? Hello, Noche.
Hello.
Hi, Noche. I think my assistant producer fell asleep. anyway, I want to know, you're from the New York Revolution Club, and you've been in Baltimore from the very beginning. Let's talk about what's going on there, what has gone on, and what's going on there now.
Okay, so yeah, I've been here actually just over a week now, and right now what I'm seeing on the streets of Baltimore is a very healthy mix of extreme celebration and bitter skepticism. People are all up and down the avenues, honking, you know, cars are just honking their horns wildly, you know, and at the same time as people are saying, this ain't over. And, you know, it's kind of like a scene, it's a little bit like a parade, where there's just lots of noise and people literally dancing in the streets and, holding up signs that they've had from the previous days of protests and uprising, and people just making noise everywhere. Because, you know, there is a feeling of jubilation at the announcement. Now, there's many people too that I've talked to already today for whom that's tempered with a sort of a bitter experience of what happens every time, you know, even there is an indictment where the cops are allowed to go off, and people have even been walking through their own thinking about how that could happen and how they could work to still get all these cops off, and how, you know, how this whole process has been part of covering it up, and if people hadn't been out in the streets, there is a sense that people have out here that if it were not for people rising up and showing them really what, you know, what it looks like when people do stand up and refuse to take this anymore, they have a deep sense that none of this would have ever come to this. And this is also coming a day after, like, people expected to get slapped in the face with a refusal to even announce any information, because, you know, yesterday we were talking about handing off the information to the prosecutor and waiting a whole other period for another investigation. The sort of surprise news for a lot of people that there is an indictment against all six cops. It's something that people are feeling they need to celebrate. At the same time, as you know, there is that skepticism, and we're also talking to people about, like, you know, we've seen this movie before. You know, there's Trayvon Martin and on and on and on, where, you know, there's an indictment against the killers, and then they go overtime to work to get all the cops off, or you know, or they could put one up and let the other cops go. But that's sort of the scene out here right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. It's very heavy because what you're just saying, too. But look, there was an indictment against the cop that and a trial even against the cop who murdered Oscar Grant, you know, a couple of years ago in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you know, going all the way back to 1992 and just in recent memory, you know, the whole point of they indicted the cops that beat the hell out of Rodney King, who didn't die just because he didn't die, you know, and they got off, and then they were brought back and they were convicted on lesser charges because there was a rebellion. You know, you think about this kind of stuff and the importance of actually how people are assessing things in Baltimore. One of the things I saw that really just drove me crazy, man, was this idea. They kept putting out in recent days, the last couple of days, they kept putting this thing out that they were almost saying, well, Freddie Gray really kind of, he just he kept banging himself against different parts of the paddy wagon, you know, that he kept throwing himself, trying to injure himself, you know? And it's like, basically they were saying he beat himself to death. And then it comes out, as Carl was talking about earlier, this whole thing about the rough ride and all this other stuff that's going on. Mm-hmm. It's a very heavy scene there, man. How are people reacting to all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, see, this is part of what's led to the, you know, some of the jubilation today, is people have been expecting a lot of slaps in the face, and they've been looking at the news and hearing all this nonsense coming out that, you know, people knowing their guts is part of and could still play a role in covering this whole thing up and letting all these cops off. And so they've been seeing this, you know, day after day, and you know, the cop's wife coming out and saying, oh, there's no way, you know, that these cops were responsible for killing him, and in fact, you know, I believe I heard this on the street in the neighborhood, but I believe I read it in USA Today that the person that, you know, that they supposedly quoted as saying Freddie, you know, did it to himself or whatever in the van, you know, who was also arrested in the van, was actually, you know, testifying about how his words were actually distorted, and it was used to just justify a media narrative that wasn't actually true. And, you know, the reality actually being that, look, you know, what they did was actually kill him. And Carl, I completely agree. All of them should have been charged with murder, or I'm not a lawyer, so maybe it had to be accessory to murder or whatever, but you know, they were all part of it. And you know, like he said, this is not something that was just on a whim. This is this is almost a studied practice of theirs to carry out this kind of brutality, while at the same time you know, people are celebrating, it is a case that people have, people feel like they won something, you know, rightfully so, you know, and but like you're saying, you know, Oscar Grant, you know, they even got the cop there with manslaughter, and I don't even think he did a year in jail, and there was talks about hiring him back after he got out. Rekia Boyd, they threw out the case, you know, in Chicago just recently in the middle of the trial without it even going to a defense. You know, this is still, you know, very much a beginning. And that's to say nothing of the fact that this has to stop. We can't just be here, you know, every time they murder somebody fighting for, you know, justice, you know, for this and that case. We actually have to continue the spirit of the April 14th, you know, that the Stop Mass Incarceration that we're called for, of going on the offensive and actually, you know, building a movement that's aiming to put a stop to police murder, so we don't have to be here talking about, you know, the next, you know, few hundred people that they've, you know, that they've murdered.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one quick question. You know, one of the things I wanted to bring out, because I read it on RevCom and Revolution Newspaper, the whole, there's actually something that happened in Baltimore. There was a certain amount of, you know, there was the uprising among the poor people, the black people living in the area around there, throughout the city, the people who've experienced this directly firsthand and know what's going on to others, you know. But there was also something that seemed to be, I noticed that there were a lot of people of different nationalities, a lot of white people, a lot of students. And then there was a night where the Baltimore police shut off the baseball stadium there and tried to keep people from even knowing what was going on. And yet many, many people came walking behind past police lines to find out what was happening and show their support in one way or another.
Yeah, it is very important. You look, you know, for too long, a lot of the action in the streets of people standing up was very devoid of white people and middle class people. And it's a very good thing that over the last few days, especially in the wake of the, you know, huge uprising, that people have not simply come out to condemn the people standing up, but have actually come out to stand with them, including many, many white people, students. You know, they could also close down some of the schools, and people came out to the neighborhood, some for the first time, to actually mix it up with the people who live here and to learn and to also share their support for the people who are standing up and you know, saying that they don't want to live this way anymore. And that is, you know, something that I'll say that the powers that be are very afraid to see. And this is, you know, this has been the case everywhere around the country. When people stand up, they find out, lo and behold, they're able to actually win over sections of people that are supposed to just look at them as criminals and monsters and not capable of anything. And this is how they were trying to paint people too, who were rising up, but they haven't been able to get away with that. And as, you know, as someone who is part of building a movement for revolution, that has, but, you know, that has tremendous significance, you know, looking towards how could a revolutionary force amongst the people actually be able to win, you know, and gain allies from different sections of society. This is something that's been very, you know, very good to see, you know, over the last few days and around the country too. You know, I've been hearing, you know, not enough, but you know, because I haven't been able to follow too much of the news, but you know, I've been hearing, you know, bits about what's been going on around the country. People standing up in, you know, New York City to Baltimore, Chicago to Baltimore, you know, Philly to Baltimore, all these up
Ferguson as well. You know,
Ferguson.
Yeah,
I met some people down here from who had come all the way from Ferguson. Tess Poe was out here to stand with the people who were facing this. You know, this is a very important, you know, moment, and we're sort of in the middle of, right, of tides shaking, you know, shaking the country, and what kind of future we get out of this is up to us. And this is the time, you know, as Carl said, to step up the struggle and to be bringing out to people, you know, for those of us who understand the need for revolution, bringing to people what's the problem and what's the solution, you know, and a lot of people here are hungry to hear. Because, you know, there's some people who remember the 68 rebellion and are questioning, why are we still here 50 years later? And some of the same things are going on and the same conditions that people are facing. How do we actually put a stop to this so that never again do we have to just keep rising up and fighting over and over again?
Right. All right, Noche, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
All right, and let's stay in touch, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Noche Diaz from the New York Revolution Club, as well as Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Now, there's something I want you to listen to from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's a piece called Yes, There's a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off, and this is taken from his speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Check this out.
Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police, how you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He talked about a black man gets pulled over by the police, and he has to say, I am reaching into my pocket for my license, because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident. You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police, because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale? This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they are forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up. They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. What happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A.? They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off.
Welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with his piece, Yes, There's a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off. And you can hear the speech that was taken from at revolutiontalk.net. And it's called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Ed Rampell, the film critic extraordinaire, to talk about Rory Kennedy and her salivating praise for the U.S. war in Vietnam. All right? Believe it or not. Okay, somebody's actually doing that. All right, so stay tuned.
Come along, come along, the end of Vietnam War, dirty smart bombs and napalm, the U.S. Army horse. Come along, come along, hey baby, don't be late.
I told you it was a short musical break. That's Allen Ginsberg with, and actually it's a remix by DJ Spooky, okay? So think about that, all right? I really like that song. I really like it a lot. I just had to play it, all right? It's basically called End the Vietnam War, all right? So let's jump into this. Ed Rampell, he's a rare soul in the world. He gets out there, he's got very progressive, one might say, I don't know, he can correct me if I think, revolutionary-minded political thoughts, and he applies that in his analysis of various films. And he's always got something that's really, really piques my interest, and I'm always really eager to get him on when I do run across that. Ed, welcome to the show.
Happy May Day, Michael,
yeah.
And listeners.
You too, man. Well, let's jump into this, Ed, real quick, because I want to talk to you about Rory Kennedy and her absolute... I watched it this morning, okay? I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I watched it this morning. And
Talk about nightmare.
Yeah, let's talk about it, man.
Well, first of all, you know that there's an old expression we're all familiar with, which is that the winners write the history. Well, this is a case of not only the losers writing the history, but the sore losers writing a totally inaccurate, propagandistic piece of disinformation. And I wouldn't even call Last Days in Vietnam a documentary. I would call it a mockumentary. But as I wrote in HollywoodProgressive.com and in People's World, not only is it like a mockumentary, but unlike This Is Spinal Tap, that famous comedic mockumentary, this is one with no laughs whatsoever. It is just appalling and tragic that somebody would try at this late stage, 40 years after, I'm sorry, Amy Goodman, it wasn't the fall of Saigon. That's not the way to look at it. 40 years ago was the liberation of Vietnam. It was the biggest defeat to U.S. imperialism and militarism and foreign policies in the entire history of what we now call the United States of America. And yet, what Rory Kennedy has tried to do remarkably, the niece of the president who raised the number of U.S. quote-unquote advisors in Vietnam from 600 to 16,000, according to CNN, what she's tried to do is put a blossom on a turd. And she has taken what she calls the last days of Vietnam, and she has tried to concoct some sort of fantasy about how noble and how heroic our intelligence officers and our remaining military personnel there were in rescuing a number of the collaborators with the United States. And in focusing her film entirely on this, on very dubious people such as Richard Armitage, who's one of the bete noirs of the left because of the suspicions swirling around his longtime connections with many covert actions, interviewing like he's a great statesman, Henry mass murderer Kissinger, and so on. At this time when U.S. foreign policy is also facing enormous disasters, she's trying to cover up what really happened in Vietnam and tried to reassure people, again, at a time when U.S. foreign policy is greatly under attack and beleaguered.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as you're talking, too, one of the points you make in the article, which I thought was, you know, really, really a very good article, and people should read it, and you can get that. What is it? It's the Hollywood Progressive?
HollywoodProgressive.com/Rory-Kennedy/, or just go to HollywoodProgressive.com. I have two other articles there about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. One is the top 10 Vietnam War movies. And by the way, Last Days in Vietnam is not on that list. And also a story called Mea Culpa Time, which is demanding that the U.S. power elite apologize to all of the anti-war activists who opposed the war in Vietnam, apologize to the vets, dead and alive, who were coerced to go there through the draft, and also apologize to the peoples of Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam.
You know, that's important in its own right, and it's going to be even more important as we go into this next month, where there's all these plans to actually start to rewrite and actually push out in a big way the whole history of the Vietnam War, the role of the soldiers in the Vietnam War, expunging, of course, the idea of, in fact, one of the films that you have is among the 10 best of Vietnam films is Sir, No Sir by Dave Zeiger, which actually brings out the whole resistance movement among the troops in Vietnam. I wanted to, so it's going to get very important. And I think one of the things that you make, the point you make about this about this film is the Kennedys, actually her and her husband, he's the writer, producer, co-writer, and her husband, Mark Bailey. What they do is they don't just seek a little change here and there, or just look like for the, let's sort of amplify the positive here. You know, they don't just do that, but they actually expunge. They actually rewrite history in a way that you started to talk about, but you present some pretty damning things. You talk about they willfully expunge history in any sort of context from their one-dimensional exercise in disinformation. And then you get into this thing about, the announcement. I was struck by the same thing when they talk about, well, as things were going down and during the Tet Offensive, that the communists executed thousands of South Vietnamese at Hue. And then you bring out that they never, ever mentioned all of the other things that were done massacre-wise. Let's talk about this. You know, the things like My Lai massacre and all the other stuff, the carpet bombing. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, first of all, I went to Vietnam last year, and it was quite an amazing experience. And let me assure you that, yes, Virginia, there is life after Uncle Sam. That, that old expression, yes, Virginia, there is a Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, these massive war crimes that the imperialists perpetrated against the people of Indochina are never mentioned in Kennedy's film. In fact, and I've seen her do separate interviews where, in fact, her very simplistic viewpoint is that, well, there was a civil war between the North and the South, and the United States backed the South, which is such a harebrained, simplistic interpretation of what happened. And she gets away with this by not only never once interviewing anybody from what was called either the National Liberation Front or the Viet Cong, which numbered in the millions, she not only never, and by the way, the ones who won the war along with their northern allies, she never interviews any of them. But worse than that, Michael, she never acknowledges that they existed. There's no acknowledgement that the NLF existed in this film, which would completely debunk the simplistic notion that this was simplistically a civil war. And by the way, Rory, if it was a civil war, I have a simple question for you. How many Vietnamese died in the American Civil War? Is there a wall somewhere in Vietnam with the name of all those Vietnamese soldiers who died in the American Civil War? This is a case. And her film is covering it up and actually serves as a way to ballyhoo ongoing meddling, sticking your nose into other people's business where it doesn't belong. And the Vietnam, the whole, not just Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, it was such a huge disaster and debacle. The U.S. involvement in it actually goes back to the 40s. And the imperialists made just one mistake after another. And they picked up where French colonialism failed at Dien Bien Phu. Then the Americans picked it up and cost our country untold billions. Remember, Dr. Martin Luther King said that the war on poverty is being lost in the battlefields of Vietnam. The colossal waste of money which the military-industrial complex profited from. But also, over 50,000 of Americans were killed, along with 3 million people in Indochina. And getting back to the losses to the Americans, how many of our young men and some young women who survived and did not come back in body bags, how many of them were disabled, physically disabled, mentally disabled. What kind of mentality is it? Support the troops. Yeah, support them by supporting policies that send them unnecessarily into harm's way. Her film never raises any of these one-sided, you know, her one-sided narrative where not one North Vietnamese, not one communist, not one Viet Cong is ever interviewed.
And quite frankly, I mean, part of the thing that hit me, too, is I think that's really important, the point you're making, and including another point you make in a review, which was, what was it, when you're talking about pretending that the NLF, the National Liberation Front, also known as the Viet Cong, but that by 1962, 300,000 people belonged to this organization. And it's kind of erasing a pretty huge pool of people. And then thinking about that as it plays out, going all the way up into the 70s, how influential, how widespread is that war tore apart this country as, you know, napalm, you know, and everybody remembers that young girl running down the street naked with her back on fire, screaming because of napalm. Then how many times was this repeated? So you think about all this stuff that gets left out, and then there's the stuff that gets brought in. I do want to just have, we have maybe 2 minutes to do this or a minute and a half. There is this, you spoke to this before, but I was just so disgusted by the roster of people she did have in her. These are bloodthirsty criminals, killers, torturers. They continue, maybe not the same exact people. Some of them are probably still around, but not the same exact people. But the CIA and all these, you know, black ops people that are out there that actually carry out the most heinous crimes against humanity in the world in service of U.S. imperialism. And they were doing that in Vietnam as well.
Yeah, it's completely uncritical. Like I did mention, Henry Kissinger, who not only appears in news clips, but he also appears in what seems to be original interviews for the films. I mean, this guy was not only responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, in Vietnam, but also in Chile, in East Timor. If there was any justice in this country, he would be brought up before a Nuremberg-type trial. And for Rory Kennedy to make this type of a one-sided film that never shows the other side of the story, if there was public money involved in this film, taxpayer dollars, and it was aired on PBS, one should look into whether or not laws were violated about using government funding to only support one side of an issue. It's against the law for that kind of preferential treatment, as Dave Robb has written in Operation Hollywood and Trisha Jenkins wrote in the CIA in Hollywood.
And we're going to have to wrap this up real quick, like 10 seconds.
Yeah, it may also violate propaganda laws. I don't know, but it should be looked into. In any case, it's a terrible film.
All right, Ed, thank you very much, and talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with film critic Ed Rampell about his recent article in Hollywood Progressive called With Liberals Like Rory Kennedy, Who Needs Reactionaries? Talking about her film, The Last Days in Vietnam, which is just, folks, you know, if you just want to get sick, you just want to get angry, go see it. Maybe just go see how the system lies through its teeth all the time, all right? All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. As I said, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, the ever-amazing, always astounding Federico Garcia. All right, so we're going to go out now with a song by Marcus Miller that's all about I Can't Breathe. Hands up, I can't breathe, all right? Talk to you again next week.